As a general principle, we prefer to have more options rather than less for our customers.
An Alaska insurance company reacts to President Obama's fix for the outcry over insurance cancellations. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, November 14th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a new study shows a higher suicide rate in Alaska communities that are farther north.
We can't really say conclusively that suicide actually does vary with latitude, but it's certainly an area that we should focus more work on in the future.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. And by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
President Obama said today insurers can continue offering the plans they intended to cancel as part of the Affordable Care Act. The announcement is a response to outcry over the president's "if you like your plan, you can keep it" promise, which turned out to be untrue for millions of Americans. Now, state insurance regulators and insurance companies have to figure out if they can make Obama's new plan work. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
Last month, Primera Alaska sent out health insurance cancellation notices to more than 5,000 people in the state. With President Obama's new announcement, the company may be able to send out very different letters to those same people. But Primera spokesperson Eric Erling says it will take a few days to sort out how to proceed.
Primera is assessing what this means. We're going to be evaluating options for our consumers and then getting them information as soon as we feasibly can on what their options are.
Erling says there's already a lot of confusion over the Affordable Care Act, and this new twist is likely to increase that confusion. And he says the change will create a lot of work for Primera, but ultimately he thinks it's good for consumers.
As a general principle, yes, we'd prefer to have more options rather than less for our customers, in helping them navigate changes related to the Affordable Care Act.
There are a lot of tricky details to consider. First, Alaska's insurance director, Brett Kolb, has to figure out whether these canceled insurance plans can be revived. He's not sure if it's possible under state law and in such a compressed timeline.
It will be a big job. A lot of the burden, I believe, would end up falling on the insurers first and then back onto the state to review rates and forms in a very expedited manner, if that's even a possibility.
Kolb plans to make a determination as quickly as possible. Senator Lisa Murkowski has been critical of President Obama's "if you like your plan, you can keep it" promise, but she's not sure the president has found a good fix.
I'm just not sure how workable this is.
And Murkowski is frustrated. The president's proposal only extends the canceled insurance plans for a limited time.
Now he's saying, well, you can keep your plan for a year if the insurance companies are able to kind of recalibrate, if you will, and provide for that policy.
Murkowski's office has heard from several Alaskans upset over their insurance plan cancellations in the last month. The State Division of Insurance estimates 9,000 Alaskans received cancellation notices this fall because of the Affordable Care Act. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Western Alaska has been racked by storms the last few days. The first round occurred Saturday night and into Sunday morning. Before cleanup efforts were even finished in some of the worst-hit communities, strong winds and coastal flooding did more damage last night. KNOM's Zachariah Hughes reports.
Back-to-back storms have slammed into communities up and down the Bering Straits region. At least four towns are working with state officials on disaster declarations since coastal flooding and storm surges damaged homes and infrastructure. Kotlik, near the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, sustained heavy damage on Sunday morning when ocean flooding was followed by sea ice which plowed through the town. City manager Lori Mike says the ice ripped off water and sewer boxes from 20 homes.
There's a lot of broken water sewer pipes. We have three loops here for the water sewer pipes. So out of those three, one loop is working, and that's about 10, 15 homes, I'm assuming, that have water, but no sump, vacuum.
Mike's concern is for the simple health and safety of those in the community.
Sewage had leaked out onto the ground, and where the water sewer boxes that got ripped off their homes, around their homes is unsanitary. And the other issue I have is the 13 homes with the water damage in their home. That's our main concern right now.
Those who cannot go back to their homes are staying with family, although most are staying at the high school in Kotlik, which serves as the evacuation center. While Kotlik was not hurt badly during last night's second batch of flooding, there are 13 families currently displaced from the weekend storms. A FEMA representative is expected to travel to Kotlik today. Homes were also damaged in the community of Stebbins in the eastern Norton Sound. According to Jeremy Zedek with the State Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, the GCI tower in Stebbins was damaged sometime early Sunday morning, and phone contact has been difficult. As of this morning, Zedek's office was in contact with community members. Stebbins Mayor Morris Nahonak said over the phone that several homes were damaged during the weekend and will be uninhabitable for months to come. Residents began evacuating on Saturday evening to the IRA building. Mayor Nahonak said that the honey bucket hauling system had been toppled as coastal barriers were overwhelmed, and the main road along with the defensive berm had been damaged. However, no injuries were reported, and the town has made a disaster declaration with the state. Shishmaref has already voted to declare a local disaster after coastal swells last night brought surges up against the town's shores. According to Shishmaref's mayor, Stanley Taktu, residents piled junk and debris to try and protect the road from flooding. And while Taktu says everyone in town is safe, people are preparing for another potentially damaging high tide, amplified by strong northwesterly winds this evening. And in Teller, on the western side of the Seward Peninsula, up to 2 feet of flooding happened last night after water overwhelmed the seawall. According to Jim Stimpfel, who works in Teller, the town's point is now cut off from the mainland by floodwaters yet to recede, and several hundred yards of beach are now gone, washed away by the surging tide. Nobody was hurt, though. Residents moved to higher ground yesterday evening, and at this point, there are no reports of private property damage. Reporting from Nome, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Schools were closed in Fairbanks for a second day today due to stormy weather. Driving conditions are slick, and more than 13,000 households were without power this morning. Golden Valley Electric Association had the number down to a few thousand by midday, but expected it will take until Friday morning to restore power to some remote neighborhoods. Utility spokeswoman Cassandra Cerny says wind-felled trees caused a lot of damage.
So torn down lines. We've also got broken cross arms. There have been blown fuses.
Temperatures hovered above freezing in Fairbanks for much of the day, but are anticipated to drop following a storm that brought snow, rain, and high winds to the region. Fairbanks hit a high of 44 degrees last night and had 5 inches of snow and a quarter inch of rain Wednesday. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the impact of the hay shortage in Alaska.
There's a lot of horses out there that are being rescued because people are just, they can't survive. They got to feed the kids first before the animals.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. And by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC.
The state is currently putting money toward 5 different large-scale projects aimed at reducing energy costs on the rail belt. Some, like subsidizing Cook Inlet gas production, impact energy costs now and in the near term. Other projects, like the proposed LNG pipeline, wouldn't affect prices for at least a decade. The question is, should the state be supporting all of the projects? Harry Noah is a former commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. He spoke at a Commonwealth North panel discussion in Anchorage on Wednesday. He says the state is playing with too many ideas.
But the fundamental problem is there aren't any decisions being made. It's just we'll spend here and we'll spend there, and sometime in the future something's going to happen and it's just going to show up. We're going to know. And it's costing a lot of money.
Noah says the solution is to create a commission that compares all of the potential projects. That way, the public will know the benefits and risks of the various ideas, like building the Susitna Dam versus trucking LNG from the North Slope to Fairbanks. Then the government and the public can make an informed decision. State agricultural officials are advising Alaska livestock owners how to cope with the high cost of feeding their animals. Feed prices have risen sharply following last summer's drought that hurt the interior hay and straw crop. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
State Agriculture Division Director Francie Havemeister has this advice for livestock owners.
Contact your suppliers to assure that they have adequate hay supply for you for the winter.
Havemeister also recommends that livestock owners work with their local veterinarian to make hay last as long as possible by, among other things, reducing wasteful practices like free feeding. That's basically just leaving hay out for animals, which can invite certain picky eaters to just sort of wastefully scatter it around.
Horses like to play with their food. If you don't free feed, you can eliminate some of that.
Most Alaska livestock owners no doubt are already aware that hay is scarce and expensive, costing around 30% more this year than last. That's because hay farmers in the interior got a late start in planting due to the late breakup and then low yields due to hot, dry summer weather. Sharon Sipe works at Alaska Farmers Co-op in Delta Junction, and she says high feed prices have forced many livestock owners to import hay from Canada or the lower 48.
We're getting a lot of out-of-state hay and straw coming in. Some of the farmers are going outside and bring it in because of the demand, and they're paying the price.
Sipe says farmers in the interior also had a hard time growing straw last summer, and so it's also in short supply and expensive.
Straw has gone up double of what it was last year.
Sipe says straw prices in Fairbanks are up to about $15 for a 50-pound bale. She says that's also caused problems for mushers, who use a lot of straw this time of year for their dogs. She says the shortage of both hay and straw is the worst she's seen in 7 years, and it's forcing a lot of livestock owners to slaughter, sell, or even give away their animals to avoid the increasingly heavy financial burden of feeding them.
There's a lot of horses out there that are being rescued because people are just, they can't survive. They got to feed the kids first before the animals.
Phil Kaspar is an agricultural agent with the UAF Cooperative Extension Service in Delta, and he says it's common for people to get rid of livestock when feed prices go up. And he says that can cause long-lasting problems for farmers' business plans.
They try to hold on to their best genetics. But if they have to cull that herd down, it can take them years to recover.
Kaspar says it also takes years for farmers who grow the feed to recover. He says these kinds of price shocks show how fragile the state agricultural sector is and why the state needs to establish a feed stockpile as one way to reduce financial risk to farmers and livestock owners.
So some of what's been discussed over the years, we haven't gotten to this point yet, but is to try to get a grain reserve in place.
Kaspar says he hopes to bring an expert here to Alaska in the coming year to talk about financial risk management strategies for farmers. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
A new report from the Alaska Division of Public Health found suicide rates are higher in more northern regions of the state. Eric Wolber is a graduate student intern with the epidemiology section. Wolber says the study breaks communities into three categories by size and road access and looks at factors that may have contributed to the suicide rate. Wolber says the fact that suicide rates increase at higher latitudes merits more research.
And the result was statistically significant even when you controlled for things like median income or the size of the population or whether the community was rural or urban. So it's a really interesting result. Because the study was exploratory, we can't really say conclusively that suicide actually does vary with latitude, but it's certainly an area that we should focus more work on in the future to see if it actually does make a difference.
Any idea at all what may be going on there with the higher latitudes?
It's actually really unclear what the reason is for the association with latitude. You could say that it has to do with differences that vary with latitude in access to services. You could say that there are what are called collinear relationships with funding for suicide prevention or weather or perhaps physical activity, access to firearms. At this point, it's really just educated conjecture which one of these variables it might be or if it's in fact a combination of all of them.
Has this been looked at before or was this really a surprising finding?
Well, geographic latitude hasn't really been looked at this way in the state of Alaska. Latitude has been shown to correlate with higher suicide rates in Japan, for instance. They have higher suicide rates in more northern prefectures. There are also high suicide rates in circumpolar communities such as in Greenland, which actually has the highest suicide rate in the world, which is actually about five times Alaska's average.
In this study, the states that have the highest rates of suicide are also states that have high rural areas or have a lot of geographic area that's rural communities. Talk a little bit about what those findings were and the states that are associated with those higher rates that are in the top one or two across the nation.
So this study didn't actually look at suicide rates by state nationwide, but that the evidence that or the correlations that we can draw from national data are still relevant to Alaska. For instance, when you look at the states that have the highest rates of suicide, they're Alaska, Montana, Wyoming. These are all states that have quite a few things in common. Among those are high amounts of rural areas and also high rates of self-reported gun ownership.
In the findings where you're looking at latitude, were there implications that suggested it's because of the extreme change in light and darkness?
So when people hear that suicide rates correlate with latitude, one of the ways that a lot of people have interpreted this is that suicide rates will be higher in areas where there are low levels of daylight in the extreme winter months in December and January. However, in Alaska and also in many other places, there's actually no increase in suicide rates during the winter months. In fact, if you look at the last 8 years of data, there really isn't any cyclical trend in suicide rates that's seasonal over the course of the year. And if anything, those rates are very, very slightly higher in May and June. That would seem to suggest that it doesn't actually have to do with darkness or seasonal affective disorder in the winter, but we certainly can't rule out that that the extreme seasonal fluctuations in daylight don't cause some sort of some effect by some other mechanism that's perhaps not an acute effect.
Eric Wolver is a graduate student in medicine and interns with the State Division of Public Health. You can find a link to the report on our website, alaskapublic.org.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority is developing the Kinnick Arm Crossing to further develop the transportation system between Anchorage and the Mat-Su Borough. The bridge could create construction jobs, provide access to land for commercial, industrial, and residential development, and shorten the route to Alaska's interior and North Slope. There's more information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority. Since 1978, the Older Persons Action Group has been the publisher of Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide newspaper for older Alaskans and their families. They now offer a digital version online at seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
Paratroopers of the 425 Brigade at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson have to be prepared to leave at a moment's notice to take on missions ranging from parachuting into a combat zone to providing humanitarian relief for natural disaster victims. APRN's Josh Edge had a chance to get a glimpse into the lives of these elite soldiers and has this story.
As I stand in the main staging area in the Joint Mobility Center, I try on a parachute to give me a feel for just how much gear a paratrooper carries when they jump out of a plane. Weighing in at nearly 50 pounds, it's like walking around with an 8-year-old strapped to your back. And it's only about a third of the weight a fully equipped paratrooper might carry into a war zone. The room is Spartan. The plain white walls are adorned with unit logos, and most of the interior is lined with rows of long wooden benches. Colonel Matt McFarland, the commander of the 425 Brigade, says the time spent in the room is the last chance to make sure everyone is ready to go and on the same page before they head out.
We come down here as we prepare for a contingency deployment, and we'll finish up our deployment preparation. Sometimes that's administration, like finishing up wills if we have to do that, and other things that allow us to deploy.
Along one of the walls, there are stations where soldiers can take care of any last-minute legal, financial, and religious needs before deployment. The days spent in that room are ones soldiers don't forget.
I remember December 9th, 2011, walking in this room.
Chase Spears is a captain with the 425.
I had said goodbye to my family earlier in the day, held my kids for the last time, and disconnected, got on a bus, and drove over here. And I remember sitting in this very room at the JMC knowing that I had at least a 10-month tour in Afghanistan ahead of me.
Spears has deployed twice, once to Kuwait and once to Afghanistan. He says even at those times when the soldiers have all said goodbye to their families, the room is filled with an air of confidence and focus.
It's just something really humbling to walk in and feel just everyone is ready. Everyone's accepted. Yep, we're going to be out. I might not be sleeping for a little while. I might not be comfortable for a little while. But this is what I've signed up to do. And this is what I'm trained to do. And this is what I'm proud to do.
Even though military units are in a constant state of training and readiness, emotions still come into play. And despite extensive preparation, it often comes down to soldiers supporting each other to make it through a deployment. Colonel Matt McFarland remembers one moment in particular when his unit was getting ready to deploy to an area near the border of Albania and Kosovo in 1999.
I had a young paratrooper that we found crying in his wall locker because he was scared.
McFarland and others talked with the soldier, encouraging him to feel confident in the abilities of his unit, his fellow soldiers, and himself. And when the time came in combat, McFarland says that soldier was able to overcome his fear and was the first to return fire.
Any soldier would attest that they rely on their buddies, we call them airborne buddies in this unit, their battle buddies, to keep them going strong when sometimes they may not be as strong as they should be for whatever reason.
So far, the paratroopers of the 425 Brigade at J-Bear have been deployed to war zones for over 3 full years on 3 different deployments since its inception in July of 2005. During their deployments, they have lost 74 soldiers in combat. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
Paratroopers from the same brigade, the 425 Brigade Special Troops Battalion on J-Bear, will also be testing out some drones while they're in Anchorage. The drones, or unmanned aerial systems, are non-lethal aircraft. They have a 14-foot wingspan and are about the size of a really small one-passenger plane. They're operated remotely from the ground by the paratroopers. Officials say the drones could be flying over J-Bear as soon as tomorrow. The aircraft will remain over the base at all times, mostly in restricted airspace. It's the first time drone training has been approved for J-Bear in Anchorage. It was Tlingit Weekend at the National Museum of the American Indian in Washington, D.C. recently. Storytellers, artists, and dancers from Alaska and Canada performed in the museum's massive atrium. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
A dozen children and assorted adults hover in the atrium, looking a little unsure. Then Jean Tagaban, a Tlingit Cherokee Filipino who grew up in Juneau, draws them in like a Pied Piper. He tells stories, some personal, some cultural, his face changing with each character. By the time he tells them about Raven the Trickster, he owns the room.
Raven had a plan. He was going to get the stars, moon, and sun for all the people. That child with the spirit of Raven put into the box in the corner of the house, the box that contained the stars, and he began to cry.
The American Indian Museum is different than the older Smithsonians that line the National Mall. They emphasize the objects in their collection and usually feature a scholarly take on what they mean. But when the American Indian Museum was finished nearly a decade ago, it was no longer cool to keep a living culture under glass and let outsiders do the interpreting. The museum has its detractors. A common complaint is that the displays are underwhelming and the explanations too skimpy. But its fans like that it lets Native Americans speak for themselves. Karen Lemmy came to the Tlingit Festival with her 2 kids. She's a curator at another Smithsonian and says this one always feels different.
For my children, I think it's better in a lot of ways because when I say we're going to the American Indian Museum, they get very excited because they know there's going to be something to do and it won't just be about looking into a glass case and trying to get an object to tell you its story by itself. It's about meeting people who are going to actually tell us a story, usually with music, usually with instruments or something unusual for them.
Shelley Laws is a master clinket weaver from Anchorage. She wraps herself in a Chilkat blanket in the museum atrium and tells stories she learned from her grandmother and uncle. She mesmerizes children with the swirl of the blanket's long fringe. She tells them it took her 6 years to weave it.
You'll feel how heavy it is? Oh, it's very warm, very heavy. Yeah.
Laws takes the robe off and hurries to a craft table where a throng of kids is waiting for her to show them what to do with colorful yarn and plastic beads. She breaks out her reading glasses and gets them started.
We're making ear loops. They're clinket decoration, so women used to wear them instead of piercing their ears, and they would dance in them, and they were very fancy. And they, yeah, and you didn't have to pierce your ears. Not that they didn't pierce their lip or whatever else they did, but those are ear loops. So
the children and the adults they came with don't begin to plumb the depth of Laws' knowledge about clinket art and weaving techniques, but she doesn't mind. Between threading needles and cutting fringe, she happily answers basic questions.
Oh, that is so cool.
And let's finish yours,
Can
too.
Can you tell her again what people make this style?
What
ladies?
Tlingit people make this style. So Tlingit women, we are from Alaska and sometimes off the coast of Canada. And being fancy for dance was really important.
Can you say Tlingit?
Tlinga.
No, Tlingit.
Okay, so here's how you do it. Go like you're going to make an L. You know when you go L? Mm-hmm. Only don't go, go. And then go ing. Fling. Fling.
Fling. Tlingit.
Perfect.
Laws says the value of such a demonstration goes beyond yarn and beads.
Making ear loops is just a view of the fact that they're doing something, and maybe it's fun. And a lot of times, all the culture you see is differences in our culture, as opposed to what's fun about a culture. And seeing what's fun about a culture makes you more comfortable with the culture. And that's partially why I do it.
She recalls a few years ago when tolerance was the buzzword for living with multiple cultures. Laws says it always struck her as kind of grim, and she thinks events like this are more effective. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Zachariah Hughes and Lorelei Kanin in Nome, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Tim Ellis in Delta. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C., and Ann Hillman from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering restorative, preventive, and cosmetic dentistry with 3 offices, 2 in Anchorage and 1 in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com. And by Rural Energy Enterprises, supplying Alaska dealers with fuel-efficient Toyo stoves and Oil Miser heaters for more than 26 years. Local dealers can be found at rural-energy.com. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.